The dilemma for any of us that have some kind of an awakening about how we don't fit here and don't fit there and have to create something is, how do you get the money, not sell out, maintain your integrity, and do good work? I mean, those are difficult questions.
Hello, everyone. Chris Martinson of Peak Prosperity here, and I have a really special guest for you today. And I'm asked often, who is it that's been instructive for me? Where do I draw my support? Who's been really important to me in my life as I do what I do in the world? And that's today's guest. Peter Gallant has been a mentor to me, an invaluable source of guidance and leadership. And today we're going to be talking about what does it mean to be in this world? Like, we talk a lot about how to do. What are we going to do? Are you going to build soil? Are you going to build resilience into your life? But we always talk about how the most important thing, at least I always talk about this, the most important thing is your own emotional resilience. Now, what does that mean? These days, we're recording this here at this moment in 2021, and that emotional resilience is becoming harder and harder to come by for a lot of people. I know because you tell me. I know because I feel it myself. Times are a little bit crazy right now. And when the people around us are losing their minds, it becomes even harder sometimes to stay moored within ourselves. Now, I think there's a larger framing for this. There's so many times Peter and I have been talking, I wished we'd had a record button pressed because I think you would have all gathered enormous amount from that conversation and those conversations. Because what we talk about often is exactly that. What is going on in the world today? How do we organize around it? What's my work in the world? How can anybody deal with this? Peter and I are both humans. We struggle with this ourselves. And in those struggles, we talk about what's going on in this world and how we can approach that. Peter has a very, very long career as a therapist. He's a very astute observer. I think you're going to get a lot out of this conversation. He's had a pretty wild and varied career in life. He's a very interesting person. So, with that, can't wait to have this conversation. Peter, welcome. It's good to have you here.
Thank you. Yeah, it's really good to be here and to see what you're up to. I've been talking about this with you now for a few years, and this is my first view of the farm, the effort, the people. It's really great.
Yeah, so first time being here, I've been pretty excited to have you here. So you laid eyes on it. What do you think?
I love the water supply.
The water supply, me too.
Yeah.
My favorite part.
You know, what you're doing agriculturally and you're thinking about that. And this really turns me on. Mm-hmm. It's the stuff of life as far as I'm concerned. You know, that relationship to the earth and how we can, you know, take care of that. You know, how we can take care of ourselves by taking care of the earth in a better way. It just feels good to watch what you're doing here.
Thanks. Speaking, I mean, we all mature and grow into our care of the earth. I remember I killed a lot of things as a boy, you know, and then I remember the day clearly when that shifted for me. I made slingshots out of whatever I could. I'd gotten perfected the whole thing. I was using the rubber tubing, the surgical tubing, making these little clay balls that would really fly straight. And I remember a chickadee flew up in a tree and I just nailed it. And it died slowly. It flapped upside down, clinging on. I cried. And I remember that was like the moment where that went away for me. Mm-hmm. Let's talk about your background. You started out as a fisherman, right?
Well, when did I start out as? I was experimenting for quite a while to see where I fit in this culture, and I couldn't find a place. I was a school teacher. I worked for an insurance industry. I was a fundraiser. I did a number of things. I ended up going back to graduate school and then working at a college where I was assistant director of the counseling center, and I get into psychological testing, and I thought that was where I belonged, that I'd get a doctorate in that and become a psychometrist. And I found that all collapsed on me when it's kind of the mismeasurement of man thing. So that didn't work for me anymore. So I was pretty much lost. And actually, my whole thrust of my life up to that point was not working. The vector was itself, my love and my life, wasn't working.
How old were you then?
I was about 30, 31. Mm-hmm. So I cashed it all in, and I got a divorce from the woman I had been with for 7 years, and then 14 years on all, 7 years courtship and 7 years marriage. And I got into a Volkswagen van and pretty much left the scene behind me. So it was all that experimentation, and I became a commercial fisherman then. So I fished the North Atlantic for about 10 years, year round.
Weren't you out in that perfect storm?
Yeah. But, you know, that's kind of like being in World War II, you know. There's not a lot to say about it, just that it was, it was the finest experience with seeing Mother Nature in her true form, I should say. I was awestruck by the power of it all. And, of course, grateful that I didn't get taken.
Who was on the boat with you that day?
Oh, about six guys. It was a boat out of Gloucester. It was a Sicilian boat, an offshore dragger. It's an old schooner that was converted. Of course, they took the sails down and put a diesel engine in these things, and then just kept patching them. It was actually a submarine chaser in World War II. So it was an old wooden vessel, deep in the water. It was 110 feet, so we survived because of its length and its depth. Boats that were only 60 feet long turned turtle on that because the waves were so high. So we made it. There was some excitement, of course, and things happened, and there was a fire in the engine room, and no one went overboard. That's a good thing, because the sea was all just foam. You know, if you fell overboard, you just disappear and suffocate. So, but there would be no hope anyway. I mean, but being overboard, you're dead anyway. But in that particular situation, it was definitely. So we survived.
That was when, in the 80s?
Yeah, what was it, late 70s?
When I was right around that time, I would have been on a traveling school. And I remember we pulled up to Lubeck, Maine, because that's where the founders of the school, we were on a school bus for a bunch of years and experiential education. But they were in Lubeck, Maine. First time I'd ever seen the tide go out in mud flats. And so we would go out, we'd dig clams. And then they said, oh, let's go catch dinner. And we got in a little rowboat. And we went out a few hundred yards and we caught some cod. It was just what you did. Like, that's what the ocean was. Today, I've been going up to Maine for a long time after that. There's no cod.
There's no codfish.
There's no cod. And there used to be urchins, but then they figured out Japanese people like to eat them, and they came with hoses and vacuumed them up. Then there's no urchins, which were the bottom of the food chain. And the last time I went up there, there weren't even any seagulls. They used to almost darken the sky at night as they went out to the rookery. There's still a few there, but I mean, you know, people hated them, rats with wings, but they're actually almost rare now by comparison. You know, so the whole, my experience in my life is the food chain has visibly collapsed.
Yeah.
Across an entire coastline that when you go, if you just drove up there from Boston, you'd go, oh my God, it's so rugged and wilt. This is rural. This is wild. It's not really any of those things anymore.
Yeah. Relatively speaking, Lubeck, of course, has 90 miles of coastline, and it's drop dead gorgeous in my estimation. I love Lubeck. But yeah, 500 years of a binge on codfish from boats from all over the world. The biomass is gone. The codfish have not returned, really. The haddock have come back a little bit, but the codfish have not. The whole structure of the ocean is completely different. You know, the lobster fishery is surviving up until now, you know,
but that's a commercial farming operation, right? Because they go out and they harvest herring and they bring them in and then they feed the lobsters. Right. They let all the females go.
Right.
And the undersized. So it's really, it's a farming operation.
Yeah, it's an aquaculture operation. Yeah. And people don't understand. There's not a lot of support for it other than finding new sources of bait, because the herring are in short supply as well. So we're using other sources of bait for that. The price is up with lobster, and things are still going strong in some of the offshore islands that I hang around occasionally. But it's an illusion.
I'm old enough that I see enormous changes in the world, right? And I was nature boy because I found I preferred being outside to inside. That's the era I grew up in. You know, if I was ever inside, my mom would find stuff for me to do, so I wasn't inside, right? And so because of that, because I was outside, because we didn't have screens and I was bored, I spent a lot of time just observing and becoming part of things. So in my boyhood, I always knew where, if you said, let's go catch a toad, it wasn't like a toad. I knew where specific ones were. Mm-hmm. Under that rock is the big one. You know, like I had this sense of place, and it's so gone now. You know, we live here on this beautiful place in Chester, Mass. It's very rural. I haven't seen a single turtle since I've been here. I mean, there's some sliders and some ponds, mm-hmm. but I mean, mm-hmm. no wood turtles, no box turtles, mm-hmm. right? Mm-hmm. This is a completely wild place. They should be thriving here, mm-hmm. but they're gone because mm-hmm. something has happened. Was mm-hmm. it too many got squished on the roads? Is it there's estrogenic, you know, hormone disruptors in the water? We don't know. But I can tell you in my own life, I've seen a vast erosion. And so somebody who's just coming into life right now wouldn't know that because of that shifting baseline phenomenon, mm-hmm. right? And I'll bet you the person who's a generation older than me back there would have their baseline would have been visibly higher. And I don't even know what to do when I read about the accounts in Maine where they would say back in the 16, 1700s that you could walk across the bay when the cod came in mm-hmm. to mm-hmm. spawn. Mm-hmm. Like it was just that thick. Mm-hmm. I can't even imagine that.
Yeah, I grew up on a peninsula where the Pollock run was a major event, and then we could go down to the rocky beach and with a heavy stick and wade out into the Pollock and club them and stun them and throw them up on the beach. That's where we went fishing.
With a club?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, yeah, that is completely gone. The idea of abundance in the time I fished, you know, the word environmentalism was just being born then,
yeah.
you know, there was no real sense of scarcity. And there were no regulations, essentially.
So 10 years commercial fishing, did you have a moment, your own chickadee moment, where you're like standing, you know, thigh deep in cod saying, what the hell am I doing?
Oh, sure. Sure. Yeah, it happened near the end of it. I was offshore sword fishing with a good friend of mine who owned the boat, and we were both sitting on the back deck on a beautiful night. We had swordfish in the hold, and we were, you know, about 3 days offshore. No single sideband radio. We had a tin boat up on the overhead for emergency, which was useless. But it was the days when the excitement was built into the risk, you know. Mm. And we just kind of looked at each other and said, this is over. We're not going to do this. We can't do this anymore. We had already stopped longlining. We were just harpooning because it was more selective. And we didn't want to use airplanes. So we were essentially putting ourselves out of business. And then we finally had to just recognize that we can't do this anymore.
Just because the fish weren't there?
No, because we couldn't do it anymore. Mm. There were still swordfish there. There were good-sized swordfish. But the jig was up with us. Mm. See, that you have to steel yourself to do that, you know, to stand on the deck and cut the throats out of codfish or to kill swordfish. You really have to shut down part of your humanity to be able to continue to do that. So that kind of sneaks up on you occasionally, and that was the end of it. Mm. And he was actually a very famous bluefin tuna fisherman that just had that epiphany. And he spent the next 14, 15 years writing a book that was essentially an apology. Hmm. So, and I was part of that awakening.
An apology to who?
To the
fish?
To the fish and to the world for that pursuit. He was kind of a maniacal pursuit, you know. Mm. There was nothing that came between him and the killing of the next fish. Those are the ones that they have to shut down all kinds of things to be able to do that.
Yeah. Yeah, because they're magnificent, magnificent fish. Mm-hmm. I mean, to take one and to not have complete reverence for what's happening. And just...
Well, the reverence, of course, is something you can't hold when you're doing it. So what happened to me was that one of my jobs was to, with a gloved hand, grab a hold of the swordfish bill when it was on the deck and saw it off, because it's when it comes aboard, it's the live swordfish bill is capable of hurting you. It's sharp. So it saw it off. So I would avert the eye of the swordfish when I did that. I didn't want to look into the eye. But one moment, a big swordfish eye, they're deep feeders, you know, they have this bulbous eye. It caught me. And I had imagined that it would be retaliation, some kind of an aggression, some kind of a moment where I'd recognize that I was doing something wrong. But what I saw was a moment of complete surrender, in that I can't even explain what it was, but I was the aggressor and it was just trying to survive for its life. But there was not anything but love in there, in that eye. It was pure love. I don't know how else to say it. And, it was a moment where, I had to acknowledge that I couldn't keep doing it. So it was right after that that we had that conversation. So something happened on that trip that wasn't just in me, it was in some of the other people on the boat. It was rising in us, and it was triggered for me by that particular moment. And that was a night when what happens when you're looking for a thermocline when you're setting a swordfish long line, it's the migration of the Gulf Stream, and you're trying to sit on the hooks on the leading edge of the Gulf Stream, and they float, a long line with balls, and they float. And if you miss that leading edge by just a little bit, you'll catch sharks, because they hang in back of the swordfish, and when the swordfish go through the herring and cut them up, the sharks won't engage with the swordfish, but they'll hang back and clean up the mess. And we caught a lot of sharks. So we were a day and a half, just taking sharks off of hooks just to save the gear, which was, a bloody massacre, essentially. There was not a market for the sharks. Mm-hmm. So that incident and the swordfish eye, and that was pretty much the end of my fishing career.
Then what happened?
I got a Volkswagen van and went to the wilderness in Oregon and did an internship in growing pot. I mean, I got taught by some of the finest pot growers, mm-hmm. The Berkeley dropouts that were squatters in the Cisco National Forest. And then later on, those same people moved to Washington State, and I spent some time there in that community. They pretty much owned a mountain, and hired their own school teacher and put a big iron gate down. I loved them all. I loved what they were about. They couldn't participate in the culture, and they decided to create their own. And, they were modern-day outlaws. Hmm.
Even then, they were looking to walk away, in essence, like the culture was not nourishing.
Oh, no. Reagan was in charge. They called him Reagan at the time. Mm-hmm. And he was sending the National Guard out to eradicate that whole culture. There was a raid up there, and they shot the farm animals and hauled people off to jail and shot the tires out of the vehicles and things. So it was war.
What was the complaint of the government, that they just weren't following the rules?
Well, it was a whole hysteria about pot, for one thing. I mean, of course, that just carries over. But the real complaint was that the ranchers down in the valley of Washington were trying to train their sons to be ranchers. And when their sons got wind of the fact that the hippies in the hills were building houses out of the money that they made selling pot and then going to Mexico for the winter, it was hard to keep them down on the farm. So when they started getting involved in that culture, then the National Guard got involved in eradicating it. So it was that political process that really did it.
And maybe some sense of, I mean, we have this story we tell ourselves in this country, that shining city on the hill, we're freedom. We're about freedom. We really promote freedom, but not really. No. If you say, I want to actually live separately from this free culture, the culture pretty much says no to that stuff, right? We have a lot of examples of that.
Yeah, that wasn't just then. Now, even in Florida, you can't, if you have a solar panel, you have to be hooked to the grid. Mm-hmm. It's against the law to live independently of the electric company. So, I mean, these are the kinds of things that are just kind of built into the system that we tend to ignore.
Yeah. Well, isn't that crazy, Macon, when you have a narrative that says we're all about freedom? People mm-hmm. admire us for our freedom, but mm-hmm. when you scratch at that even a tiny bit, mm-hmm. that's not the actual reality. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. As much as I like my town government, and I love it, I rent my house from them. Right? I own mm-hmm. it, but I mean, I'm renting mm-hmm. here. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And if I somehow fell off of my money wagon, I would lose all of this because I couldn't afford the rental costs.
Right. That's right. Yeah. Yeah. And I think that kind of fear is built into every generation coming through. And that's how you keep them down on the farm. I mean, it's mm-hmm. just the way it works. You know?
So somewhere after the van and the mountain, the Pop Mountain, yeah, you became a therapist mm-hmm. and you worked with addiction treatment for a while. Mm-hmm. Take us through that part. I mean, how did you end up in, like where was your moment where you said, therapy is for me, and how did you go about practicing that?
Well, I was trained as a therapist before I had the job at the college, and then I just dropped out. So all of this experience was during that time. There was a moment. I had a two-year-old child, and I was trying to make a decision. I was back in Massachusetts at my house down in Newbury, trying to make a decision about whether my people lived out in Washington State up on the mountain and I should go back there and participate in that, or find a job. Mm.
Two-year-olds kind of force those decisions sometimes.
Yeah, but I was pretty unemployable. I didn't have the right attitude. I had escaped and I was just not a good candidate for recapture. So it was a very stressful time. And then a sister of mine said, I'm going to an AA meeting tonight. Do you want to try it? And my reaction was, who, me? Really? Why would I want an AA meeting? She said, well, just give it a try. So I was desperate enough. I had bottomed out. And I knew I was in trouble, but I didn't know it had anything to do with alcohol. So I went and immediately identified with what they said was going on with them. Mm-hmm. That was me. And I stopped drinking. And that was 40 years ago. So when I stopped drinking, I had to find a way to get the money, since I wasn't going to be an outlaw anymore. Mm-hmm. I wasn't going to be a smuggler. I wasn't going to be a pot grower. I wasn't going to do any of that. So that started me on I got a job on the night shift in Gloucester where I was a fisherman. And oddly enough, my job then was, and I was actually, I don't think I had talked to people like that for many, many years that worked there, you know, straight people that actually went to work and had a life and raised their children and did all that. I was out there. So I got reintroduced to what the culture was like, the culture that I was born into. And I found that they had not made a diagnosis of alcoholism ever on the psychiatric unit. So I was on the night shift and my job was to keep people from killing themselves. And I was bored, so I started interviewing people. And I was learning a lot about alcoholism. I was devouring everything I could find about it for my own education. So I started making notes in the charts, and it riled the psychiatrist to a place where they were arguing with me about that.
What kind of notes?
Well, I was identifying alcoholism, and mm-hmm. they weren't diagnosing it as such. So essentially, I was arguing for them to change the diagnosis so we could treat it properly and stop giving them medication. Mm-hmm. So that went on for about a year. And then I asked if I could have, if I could get a van rather than standing here around here trying to make sure people didn't kill themselves. I wanted to load half of them, at least on the unit, into a van, take them to an AA meeting. And they all started getting better. So that was the birth of a addictions treatment program. So I started working days, and we had a viable addictions treatment program. I opened an outpatient department. We had about, 10 therapists working. And it was what the city needed. And it was alcoholism, heroin addiction was running rampant at that time.
Mm-hmm.
So it really took off. So that was, so I had to learn about alcoholism and treatment. I went up to the Meadows and studied the PMLD and took some other trainings, and it was a great time. I did that for 7 years. And then I went into private practice. So many of those people that were in that system became long-term clients of mine, mostly men.
Mm-hmm.
And I did it for 25 years. I had an office in Gloucester and an office in Newburyport. I closed the Gloucester office and worked in Newburyport, and then took to the woods after about 12 years. And that was Stone Oak. That's when you, I think that's when I met you.
That's when we met, yeah.
Yeah. And so I, Pam and I, my wife, we saw couples out there. And I had men's groups, she had women's groups. And so we had a whole life of that in kind of a general practice. And I got tied into the Shalom Treatment Center, and that was a great stimulation for me and my practice.
And for my audience, this place you lived out in the woods called Stone Oak was most people would recognize as a highly resilient sort of facility, right? So you have your own water worked out, your own electricity worked out. It was way out of, I mean, way out.
Yeah, it was 2.5 miles off the road.
A dirt, poorly maintained dirt road, I might mention.
Yeah, it was an old logging road.
Yeah. So you were off grid and all of that way before it was like a current thing. But I think that harkens back to your time in Oregon and then Washington, possibly, you know.
Yeah, just, well, that was in my bones at that point.
Yeah.
So, but, you know, I had this, you know, the dilemma for any of us that have some kind of an awakening about how we don't fit here and don't fit there and have to create something is, how do you get the money, not sell out, maintain your integrity, and do good work? I mean, those are difficult questions. And I had to wrestle with that for a long time. And I came up with that we could live close to the land, raise a lot of our food, and operate from that platform so that life itself became an art form. Doing stonework and raising food and learning how to love and teaching people as best we could about loving.
Now, when I first met you, it was in the context of my prior marriage was in the process of falling apart. And my then wife, Becca, and I, she'd recommended maybe we should go to couples therapy. And I was kind of resistant, but you won me over right away because the first thing out of your mouth when we sat down, so Pam's over there on Becca's side, you're over here on my side, as it were. So it's balanced. It's not the two of us against one person, which is a weird dynamic, I think, possibly. And you said, just to get something clear, I'm not here to save your marriage.
Did I say that?
Yes, you did.
Okay.
You said, we're here to put your cards on the table. And if you have a hand that can be played, let's play that hand. I immediately, that was the right answer for me in that moment. Cause it has to be how it is.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. Yeah. Marriage is not the client.
Mm-hmm. Marriage is not the client.
Yeah. I mean, personal development is the client. I mean, I had a bias against marriage because I think it militates against personal development. Anyway, that's the contract that you sign when you get married in a conventional sense. And I had to wrestle with that in my own life that I felt really badly about breaking that contract. But I, developmentally, we were going in different directions for a long time. And I had no choice. But I had to suffer the consequences of not being supported at all in that, in the culture I was living in. So I had to leave that whole culture behind and find a new way of life. And that was Stone Oak was part of the expression of that.
Yeah. Well, I mean, isn't that always the case that if you are ready to go to another layer of development, you have to leave a lot behind sometimes. Yeah. You got to blow things up.
Yeah.
Right. It takes an enormous, I remember still acutely dodging away from the idea of divorce in my own life, because mm-hmm. when I looked forward into it, I'm like, oh, and it's, let me be clear. It's a shit show, right? Mm-hmm. There's details mm-hmm. and there's this, and it's, mm-hmm. it's not easy and it's very disruptive and all of that. But still, if you want to grow and you want to move ahead in a new direction, you got to go through that, mm-hmm. right? You have to mm-hmm. do that. So mm-hmm. that's something I wrestled with for a long time. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. But then over time, you know, you became involved to discover I'm really a very mission-driven guy, and I got a lot of things I want to do in this world. And I found that your way of approaching, how would I describe it? It's kind of like you have a really no bullshit way about it. It's like, here's your experience. Here's what you've seen. You can either do this or do that. It was just very clear, even if I didn't know what's like the answers to it, you know, the questions that you would pose. But I think that's what we need now in this time mm-hmm. That we're living in right now is mm-hmm. like, it's just, can we just be done with the bullshit? Mm-hmm. And so if we strip the bullshit away, mm-hmm. like, where really are we in this story? Mm-hmm. And you're of an age, you've seen the earth go through massive changes. Mm-hmm. When you were born, I'm going to guess there were maybe 2.5 billion people on the planet. Now mm-hmm. there's nearly 8, mm-hmm. right? That's unbelievable, mm-hmm. right? The pressure that puts on the whole thing. So from a macro perspective, when you look at sort of the world, not US, not politics, none of that crap. From a macro perspective, what's your diagnosis? What are we facing? How do you see it?
Well, the trajectory is one of extinction, of course. I mean, how else can you see this? You know, for the longest time, I thought maybe I could at least affect something there. I'm not so sure that's true of me anymore. I mean, I've been doing this thought process since the 60s, you know, since the population bomb and all that, you know, that stuff really riled me up. But then I somehow forgot it, you know. But it's roaring back now in my consciousness. So,
and what's that?
I think now it's almost like we have to figure out what kind of dance we're going to do as you circle a drain in some ways, you know, and that sounds like a very depressed kind of, mm-hmm. you know, thought, and it is. But there are, you know, some caveats around that. More and more a compulsion in my life to identify what I love and to pursue it. And that means to identify the people that I'm willing to love fully, and to dedicate myself to that. I want to know where I belong in that sense, who I belong with. I want to know where my water is and my land is. I want to be able to relate to it fully, daily, and love it. So when I say the dance is mostly with my own internal mechanisms so that I can create the chemical processes, neurotransmitters and such in my own body that I want to inhabit it. I want to inhabit my life, you know, because otherwise it's too grim, really. So it's a source of joy for me to be able to focus in that direction.